Propaganda by Edward L. Bernays. An adult brain audiobook production read to you by Graham Dunlop. Chapter 1. Organizing Chaos. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. This is a logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they are to live together as a smoothly functioning society. Our invisible governors are, in many cases, unaware of the identity of their fellow members in the inner cabinet. They govern us by their qualities of natural leadership, their ability to supply needed ideas, and by their key position in the social structure. Whatever attitude one chooses to take toward this condition, it remains a fact that in almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons, a trifling fraction of our 120 million, who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind, who harness old social forces and contrive new ways to bind and guide the world. It is not usually realized how necessary these invisible governors are to the orderly functioning of our group life. In theory, every citizen may vote for whom he pleases. Our Constitution does not envisage political parties as part of the mechanism of government, and its framers seem not to have pictured to themselves the existence in our national politics of anything like the modern political machine. But the American voters soon found, without organization and direction, their individual votes, cast perhaps for dozens or hundreds of candidates, would produce nothing but confusion. Invisible government in the shape of rudimentary political parties arose almost overnight. Ever since then, we have agreed, for the sake of simplicity and practicality, that party machines should narrow down the field of choice to two candidates, or at most three or four. In theory, every citizen makes up his mind on public questions and matters of private conduct. In practice, if all men had to study for themselves the abstruse economic, political, and ethical data involved in every question, they would find it impossible to come to a conclusion about anything. We have voluntarily agreed to let an invisible government sift the data and high-spot the outstanding issues so that our field of choice shall be narrowed to practical proportions. From our leaders and the media they use to reach the public, we accept the evidence and the demarcation of issues bearing upon public questions. From some ethical teacher, be it a minister, a favorite essayist, or merely prevailing opinion, we accept the standardized code of social conduct, to which we conform most of the time. In theory, everybody buys the best and cheapest commodities offered him on the market. In practice, if everyone went around pricing and chemically testing before purchasing the dozens of soaps or fabrics or brands of bread which are for sale, economic life would become hopelessly jammed. To avoid such confusion, society consents to have its choice narrowed to ideas and objects brought to its attention through propaganda of all kinds. There is consequently a vast and continuous effort going on to capture our minds in the interest of some policy or commodity or idea. It might be better to have, instead of propaganda and special pleading, committees of wise men who would choose our rulers, dictate our conduct, private and public, and decide upon the best types of clothes for us to wear and the best kinds of food for us to eat. But we have chosen the opposite method, that of open competition. We must find a way to make free competition function with reasonable smoothness. To achieve this, society has consented to permit free competition to be organized by leadership and propaganda. Some of the phenomena of this process are criticized. The manipulation of news, the inflation of personality, and the general ballyhoo by which politicians and commercial products and social ideas are brought to the consciousness of the masses. The instruments by which public opinion is organized and focused may be misused, but such organization and focusing are necessary to orderly life. As civilization has become more complex, and as the need for invisible government has been increasingly demonstrated, the technical means have been invented and developed by which opinion may be regimented. With the printing press and the newspaper, the railroad, the telephone, telegraph, radio, and airplanes, ideas can be spread rapidly and even instantaneously over the whole of America. H.G. Wells senses the vast potentialities of these inventions when he writes in the New York Times, "Modern means of communication, the power afforded by print, telephone, wireless, and so forth, of rapidly putting through directive, strategic, or technical conceptions to a great number of cooperating centers, of getting quick replies and effective discussion, have opened up a new world of political processes. Ideas and phrases can now be given an effectiveness greater than the effectiveness of any personality and stronger than any sectional interest. The common design can be documented and sustained against perversion and betrayal. It can be elaborated and developed steadily and widely without personal, local, and sectional misunderstanding." What Mr. Wells says of political processes is equally true of commercial and social processes and all manifestations of mass activity. The groupings and affiliations of society today are no longer subject to local and sectional limitations. When the Constitution was adopted, the unit of organization was the village community, which produced the greater part of its own necessary commodities and generated its group ideas and opinions by personal contact and discussion directly among its citizens. But today, because ideas can be instantaneously transmitted to any distance and to any number of people, this geographical integration has been supplemented by many other kinds of grouping, so that persons having the same ideas and interests may be associated and regimented for common action, even though they live thousands of miles apart. It is extremely difficult to realize how many and diverse are these cleavages in our society. They may be social, political, economic, racial, religious, or ethical, with hundreds of subdivisions of each. In the World Almanac, for example, the following groups are listed under the A's: the League to Abolish Capital Punishment, Association to Abolish War, American Institute of Accountants, Actors Equity Association, Actuarial Association of America, International Advertising Association, National Aeronautic Association, Albany Institute of History and Art, Amen Corner, American Academy in Rome, American Antiquarian Society, League for American Citizenship, American Federation of Labor, AMORC, Rosicrucian Order, Andiron Club, American Irish Historical Association, Anti-Cigarette League, Anti-Profanity League, Archaeological Association of America, National Archery Association, Aryan Singing Society, American Astronomical Association, Ayrshire Breeders Association, Aztec Club of 1847. There are many more under the A section of this very limited list. The American Newspaper Annual and Directory for 1928 lists 22,128 periodical publications in America. I've selected at random the N's published in Chicago. They are Narod, Bohemian Daily Newspaper, Narod Polski, Polish Monthly, NARD, N-A-R-D, Pharmaceutical, National Corporation Reporter, National Culinary Progress for Hotel Chefs, National Dog Journal, National Drug Clerk, National Engineer, National Grocer, National Hotel Reporter, National Income Tax Magazine, National Jeweler, National Journal of Chiropractic, National Livestock Producer, National Miller, National Nut News, National Poultry, Butter and Egg Bulletin, National Provisioner for Meat Packers, National Real Estate Journal, National Retail Clothier, National Retail Lumber Dealer, National Safety News, National Spiritualist, National Underwriter, The Nation's Health, Nagianos, Lithuanian Daily Newspaper, Newcomer, Republican Weekly for Italians, Daily News, The New World, Catholic Weekly, North American Banker, North American Veterinarian. The circulation of some of these publications is astonishing. The National Livestock Producer has a sworn circulation of 155,978. The National Engineer of 20,328. The New World, an estimated circulation of 67,000. The greater number of the periodicals listed, chosen at random from among 22,128, have a circulation in excess of 10,000. The diversity of these publications is evident at a glance. Yet they can only faintly suggest the multitude of cleavages which exist in our society, and along which flow information and opinion carrying authority to the individual groups. Here are the conventions scheduled for Cleveland, Ohio, recorded in a single recent issue of World Convention Dates, a fraction of the 5,500 conventions and rallies scheduled, the Employing Photo Engravers Association of America, the Outdoor Writers Association, the Knights of St. John, the Walter League, the National Knitted Outerwear Association, the Knights of St. Joseph, the Royal Order of Sphinx, the Mortgage Bankers Association, the International Association of Public Employment Officials, the Kiwanis Club of Ohio, the American Photo Engravers Association, the Cleveland Auto Manufacturer Show, the American Society of Heating and Ventilating Engineers. Other conventions to be held in 1928 were those of the Association of Limb Manufacturers Associations, the National Circus Fans Association of America, the American Naturopathic Association, the American Trap Shooting Association, the Texas Folklore Association, the Hotel Greeters, the Fox Breeders Association, the Insecticide and Disinfectant Association, the National Association of Egg Case and Egg Case Filler Manufacturers, the American Bottlers of Carbonated Beverages, the National Pickle Packers Association, not to mention the Terrapin Derby, most of them with banquets and orations attached. If all these thousands of formal organizations and institutions could be listed, and no complete list has ever been made, they would still represent but part of those existing less formally but leading vigorous lives. Ideas are sifted and opinions stereotyped in the neighborhood bridge club. Leaders assert their authority through community drives and amateur theatricals. Thousands of women may unconsciously belong to a sorority which follows the fashion set by a single society leader. Life satirically expresses this idea in the reply which it represents as American, as giving to the Britisher who praises this country for having no upper and lower classes or castes. Yeah, all we have is the 400, the white-collar men, bootleggers, Wall Street barons, criminals, the DAR, the KKK, the colonial dames, the Masons, Kiwanis and Rotarians, the KFC, the Elks, the Censors, the Cognoscenti, the morons, the heroes like Lindy, the WCTU, politicians, Mencenites, the Bubosi, immigrants, broadcasters, and the rich and poor. Yet it must be remembered that these thousands of groups interlace. John Jones, besides being a Rotarian, is a member of a church, of a fraternal order, of a political party, of a charitable organization, of a professional organization, of a local chamber of commerce, of a league for or against prohibition, or of a society for or against lowering the tariff, and a golf club. The opinions which he receives as a Rotarian, he will tend to disseminate in the other groups in which he may have influence. This invisible intertwining structure of groupings and associations is the mechanism by which democracy has organized its group mind and simplified its mass thinking. To deplore the existence of such a mechanism is to ask for a society such as never was and never will be. To admit that it exists, but expect that it shall not be used, is unreasonable. Emil Ludwig represents Napoleon as ever on the watch for indications of public opinion, always listening to the voice of the people, a voice which defies calculation. "Do you know," he said in those days, "what amazes me more than all else? The the impotence of force to organize anything. It is the purpose of this book to explain the structure of the mechanism which controls the public mind, and to tell how it is manipulated by the special pleader who seeks to create public acceptance for a particular idea or commodity. It will attempt at the same time to find the due place in the modern democratic scheme for this new propaganda and to suggest its gradually evolving code of ethics and practice. Chapter 2. The New Propaganda. In the days when kings were kings, Louis XIV made his modest remark, "L'état, c'est moi." He was nearly right. But times have changed. The steam engine, the multiple press, and the public school, that trio of the Industrial Revolution, have taken the power away from kings and given it to the people. The people actually gained power which the king lost. For economic power tends to draw after it political power, and the history of the Industrial Revolution shows how that power passed from the king and the aristocracy to the bourgeoisie. Universal suffrage and universal schooling reinforced this tendency, and at last even the bourgeoisie stood in fear of the common people, for the masses promised to become king. Today, however, a reaction has set in. The minority has discovered a powerful help in influencing majorities. It has been found possible so to mold the mind of the masses that they will throw their newly gained strength in the desired direction. In the present structure of society, this practice is inevitable. Whatever of social importance is done today, whether in politics, finance, manufacture, agriculture, charity, education, or other fields, must be done with the help of propaganda. Propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government. Universal literacy was supposed to educate the common man to control his environment. Once he could read and write, he would have a mind fit to rule. So ran the democratic doctrine. But instead of a mind, universal literacy has given him rubber stamps inked with advertising slogans, with editorials, with published scientific data, with the trivialities of the tabloids and the platitudes of history, but quite innocent of original thought. Each man's rubber stamps are the duplicates of millions of others, so that when those millions are exposed to the same stimuli, all receive identical imprints. It may seem an exaggeration to say that the American public gets most of its ideas in this wholesale fashion. The mechanism by which ideas are disseminated on a large scale is propaganda, in the broad sense of an organized effort to spread a particular belief or doctrine. I am aware that the word propaganda carries to many minds an unpleasant connotation. Yet, whether in any instance propaganda is good or bad depends upon the merit of the cause urged and the correctness of the information published. In itself, the word propaganda has certain technical meanings which, like most things in this world, are neither good nor bad, but custom makes them so. I find the word defined in Funken-Wagnall's dictionary in four ways. 1. A society of cardinals, the overseers of foreign missions, also the College of the Propaganda at Rome, founded by Pope Urban VIII in 1627, for the education of missionary priests, Sacred College de Propaganda Fide. 2. Hence, any institution or scheme for propagating a doctrine or system. 3. Effort directed systematically toward the gaining of public support for an opinion or a course of action. And 4. The principles advanced by a propaganda. The Scientific American, in a recent issue, pleads for the restoration to respectable usage of that fine old word, propaganda. "There is no word in the English language," it says, "whose meaning has been so sadly distorted as the word propaganda. The change took place mainly during the late war, when the term took on a decidedly sinister complexion. If you turn to the standard dictionary, you will find that the word was applied to a congregation or society of cardinals for the care and oversight of foreign missions, which was instituted at Rome in the year 1627. It was applied also to the College of the Propaganda at Rome that was founded by Pope Urban VIII for the education of the missionary priests. Hence, in later years, the word came to be applied to any institution or scheme for propagating a doctrine or system. Judged by this definition, we can see that in its true sense, propaganda is a perfectly legitimate form of human activity. Any society, whether it be social, religious, or political, which is possessed of certain beliefs and sets out to make them known, either by the spoken or written words, is practicing propaganda. Truth is mighty and must prevail, and if any body of men believe that they have discovered a valuable truth, it is not merely their privilege but their duty to disseminate that truth. If they realize, as they quickly must, that the spreading of the truth can be done upon a large scale and effectively only by organized effort, they will make use of the press and the platform as the best means to give it wide circulation. Propaganda becomes vicious and reprehensive only when its authors consciously and deliberately disseminate what they know to be lies, or when they aim at effects which they know to be prejudicial to the common good. Propaganda, in its proper meaning, is a perfectly wholesome word, of honest parentage and with an honorable history. The fact that it should today be carrying a sinister meaning merely shows how much of the child remains in the average adult. A group of citizens writes and talks in favor of a certain course of action in some debatable question, believing that it is promoting the best interest of the community. Propaganda? Not a bit of it. Just a plain, forceful statement of truth. But let another group of citizens express opposing views, and they are promptly labeled with the sinister name of propaganda. What is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, says a wise old proverb. Let us make haste to put this fine old word back where it belongs, and restore its dignified significance for the use of our children and our children's children. The extent to which propaganda shapes the progress of affairs about us may surprise even well-informed persons. Nevertheless, it is only necessary to look under the surface of the newspaper for a hint as to propaganda's authority over public opinion. Page 1 of the New York Times, on the day these paragraphs are written, contains 8 important news stories. 4 of them, or one half, are propaganda. The casual reader accepts them as accounts of spontaneous happenings. But are they? Here are the headlines which announce them. 12 nations warn China real reform must come before they give relief. Pritchett reports Zionism will fail. Realty men demand a transit inquiry. And our living standard highest in history, says Hoover Report. Take them in order. The article on China explains the joint report of the Commission on Extraterritoriality in China, presenting an exposition of the powers stand in the Chinese muddle. What it says is less important than what it is. It was made public by the State Department today, with the purpose of presenting to the American public a picture of the State Department's position. Its source gives it authority, and the American public tends to accept and support the State Department view. The report of Dr. Pritchett, a trustee of the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace, is an attempt to find the facts about this Jewish colony in the midst of a restless Arab world. When Dr. Pritchett's survey convinced him that in the long run Zionism would bring more bitterness and more unhappiness both for the Jew and for the Arab, this point of view was broadcast with all the authority of the Carnegie Foundation, so that the public would hear and believe. The statement by the president of the Real Estate Board of New York and Secretary Hoover's report are similar attempts to influence the public toward an opinion. These examples are not given to create the impression that there is anything sinister about propaganda. They are set down rather to illustrate how conscious direction is given to events and how the men behind these events influence public opinion. As such, they are examples of modern propaganda. At this point, we may attempt to define propaganda. Modern propaganda is a consistent, enduring effort to create or shape events to influence the relations of the public to an enterprise, idea, or group. This practice of creating circumstances and of creating pictures in the minds of millions of persons is very common. Virtually no important undertaking is now carried on without it, whether that enterprise be building a cathedral, endowing a university, marketing a movie picture, floating a large bond issue, or electing a president. Sometimes the effect on the public is created by a professional propagandist, sometimes by an amateur deputed for the job. The important thing is that it is universal and continuous. And in its sum total, it is regimenting the public mind every bit as much as an army regiments the bodies of its soldiers. So vast are the numbers of minds which can be regimented, and so tenacious are they when regimented, that a group at times offers an irresistible pressure before which legislators, editors, and teachers are helpless. The group will cling to its stereotype, as Walter Lippmann calls it, making of those supposedly powerful beings, the leaders of public opinion, mere bits of driftwood in the surf. When an imperial wizard, sensing what is perhaps hunger for an ideal, offers a picture of a nation all Nordic and nationalistic, the common man of the older American stock, feeling himself elbowed out of his rightful position and prosperity by the newer immigrant stocks, grasps the picture which fits it so neatly with its prejudices and makes it his own. He buys the sheet and pillowcase costume and bands with his fellows by the thousand into a huge group powerful enough to swing state elections and to throw a ponderous monkey wrench into a national convention. In our present social organization, approval of the public is essential to any large undertaking. Hence, a laudable movement may be lost unless it impresses itself on the public mind. Charity, as well as business and politics and literature, for that matter, have had to adopt propaganda. For the public must be regimented in giving money just as it must be regimented into tuberculosis prophylaxis. The Near East Relief, the Association for the Improvement of the Condition of the Poor of New York, and all the rest have to work on public opinion just as though they had tubes of toothpaste to sell. We are proud of our diminishing infant death rate, and that too is the work of propaganda. Propaganda does exist on all sides of us, and it does change our mental pictures of the world. Even if this be unduly pessimistic and that remains to be proved, the opinion reflects a tendency that is undoubtedly real. In fact, its use is growing as its efficiency in gaining public support is recognized. This then evidently indicates the fact that anyone with sufficient influence can lead sections of the public, at least for a time and for a given purpose. Formerly, the rulers were the leaders. They laid out the course of history by the simple process of doing what they wanted. And if nowadays the successors of the rulers, those whose position or ability gives them power, can no longer do what they want without the approval of the masses, they find in propaganda a tool which is increasingly powerful in gaining that approval. Therefore, propaganda is here to stay. It was, of course, the astounding success of propaganda during the war that opened the eyes of the intelligent few in all departments of life to the possibilities of regimenting the public mind. The American government and numerous patriotic agencies developed a technique which, to most persons accustomed to bidding for public acceptance, was new. They not only appealed to the individual by means of every approach, visual, graphic, and auditory, to support the national endeavor, but they also secured the cooperation of the key men in every group, persons whose mere word carried authority to hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of followers. They thus automatically gained the support of fraternal, religious, commercial, patriotic, social, and local groups whose members took their opinions from their accustomed leaders and spokesmen, or from the periodical publications which they were accustomed to read and believe. At the same time, the manipulators of patriotic opinion made use of the mental clichés and the emotional habits of the public to produce mass reactions against the alleged atrocities, the terror and the tyranny of the enemy. It was only natural after the war ended that intelligent persons should ask themselves whether it was not possible to apply a similar technique to the problems of peace. As a matter of fact, the practice of propaganda since the war has assumed very different forms from those prevalent 20 years ago. This new technique may fairly be called the new propaganda. It takes account not merely of the individual nor even of the mass mind alone, but also and especially of the anatomy of society with its interlocking group formations and loyalties. It sees the individual not only as a cell in the social organism, but as a cell organized into the social unit. Touch a nerve at a sensitive spot, and you get an automatic response from certain specific members of the organism. Business offers graphic examples of the effect that may be produced upon the public by interested groups, such as textile manufacturers losing their markets. This problem arose not long ago when the velvet manufacturers were facing ruin because their product had long been out of fashion. Analysis showed that it was impossible to revive a velvet fashion within America. Anatomical hunt for the vital spots. Paris, obviously, but yes and no. Paris is the home of fashion. Lyon is the home of silk. The attack had to be made at the source. It was determined to substitute purpose for chance and to utilize the regular sources for fashion distribution and to influence the public from these sources. A velvet fashion service, openly supported by the manufacturers, was organized. Its first function was to establish contact with the Lyon manufacturers and the Paris couturiers to discover what they were doing, to encourage them to act on behalf of velvet, and to help in the proper exploitation of their wares. An intelligent Parisian was enlisted in the work. He visited Lanvin and Worth, Agnes and Patou and others, and induced them to use velvet in their gowns and hats. It was he who arranged for the distinguished countess this or duchess that to wear the hat or the gown. And as for the presentation of the idea to the public, the American buyer or the American woman of fashion was simply shown the velvet creations in the atelier of the dressmaker or the milliner. She bought the velvet because she liked it and because it was in fashion. The editors of the American magazines and fashion reporters of the American newspapers, likewise subjected to the actual, although created, circumstance, reflected it in their views, which in turn subjected the buyer and the consumer here to the same influences. The result was that what was at first a trickle of velvet became a flood. A demand was slowly but deliberately created in Paris and America. A big department store aiming to be a style leader advertised velvet gowns and hats on the authority of the French couturiers and quoted original cables received from them. The echo of the new style note was heard from hundreds of department stores throughout the country which wanted to be style leaders too. Bulletins followed dispatches, the mail followed the cables, and the American woman traveler appeared before the ship news photographers in velvet gown and hat. The created circumstances had their effect. Fickle fashion has veered to velvet, was one newspaper comment. And the industry in the United States again kept thousands busy. The new propaganda, having regard to the constitution of society as a whole, not infrequently serves to focus and realize the desires of the masses. A desire for a specific reform, however widespread, cannot be translated into action until it is made articulate and until it has exerted sufficient pressure upon the proper lawmaking bodies. Millions of housewives may feel that manufactured foods deleterious to health should be prohibited, but there is little chance that their individual desires will be translated into effective legal form unless their half-expressed demand can be organized, made vocal, and concentrated upon the state legislature or upon the federal Congress in some mode, which will produce the results they desire. Whether they realize it or not, they call upon propaganda to organize and effectuate their demand. But clearly it is the intelligent minorities which need to make use of propaganda continuously and systematically. In the active proselytizing minorities in whom selfish interests and public interests coincide, lie the progress and development of America. Only through the active energy of the intelligent few can the public at large become aware of and act upon new ideas. Small groups of persons can and do make the rest of us think what they please about a given subject. But there are usually proponents and opponents of every propaganda, both of whom are equally eager to convince the majority. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.